right here at Sharp Passes Gallery this afternoon. I have a good-looking man. Whoops, I guess it's not really because Lincoln wasn't that good-looking, but I got a good-looking man sitting across from me here today. Gerald Pitts, he is an Lincoln presenter, and he's here with us today. He's dressed in full garb as Lincoln, so you'll be able to check out the video, and if you go to Facebook, you'll see our picture on WCRS Radio right there on Facebook, so make sure you check that out. But Gerald, how you doing today?
I'm doing quite well. I haven't met anyone by the name of Booth recently.
No, that's probably a good thing as far as you're concerned. Now, we are going to be talking to him as Lincoln a little later in the show, but the first part of the show, we are going to be talking to Gerald here. You know, summoning a seance here. I've never done this before, so this will be an interesting experience here today. But, Gerald, where are you from originally?
I was born in Lawrence and have lived in Greenwood for at least 38 years.
At least 38 years. And I understand you were in the Army.
I was in the Army for 30 years, served all over the country. One of my last assignments was to help plan the medical logistics needed for Operation Desert Storm and make sure we had enough medical equipment, supplies, and so forth available for that conflict.
Now, this is an interesting point you just told me before we went on the air. How many body bags did they anticipate?
The prior planning, we based our estimates on call for 10,000 body bags that might have been necessary. But given the way the conflict worked out with the end run to the west around the major Iraqi force, we were needed only about 250 of them, fortunately.
Wow. Well, any life lost is a loss, but such a massive amount. I don't think anybody else would have thought about, you know, having 10,000 body bags. That's phenomenal.
They analyzed previous conflicts and battles and the strategic planning and the enemy you're facing and a worst-case scenario, it might have been necessary to have that many.
Wow. Unbelievable. Well, we sure are glad you're here, and we want to thank you for your service to our country. Our country is better because of people like you.
No, thank you.
And so after you got out, now it says something here about the Soldier's Medal in the name of President Reagan in 1985. What was that about?
That was an incident that occurred in May of 84. I was driving on the Florida Turnpike about noon, and the driver in front of me lost control and veered into the guardrail on the right and then back to the left, and his vehicle climbed up on top of the concrete barrier, which scraped the underside of the gas tank and ruptured it, and his vehicle finally jumped back down into the right-hand lane, and a flame trail ran from the bright red embers of the metal on top of the barrier, and it was like watching in slow motion the gunpowder trail of Yosemite Sam and Bugs Bunny. Mm-hmm. And I stopped just as there was a muffled whomp and a fireball about 30 feet high shot up from the rear of the car. And I jumped out, and I couldn't see the car at all for the fireball, but I could tell that the doors had not opened. So I realized that the driver must still be inside the car. And I ran forward, jumped over the barrier on the left, and then back again, and ran back and grabbed the door and pulled it open, grabbed the driver's arm and dragged him out and carried him about 75 yards. He had a triple fracture of the left leg and a broken finger, but other than that, he had no burns.
Wow.
About an hour afterwards, as I was driving on, I kept smelling something burning, and I stopped on the shoulder and thinking my car might be on fire, and I realized that the fire had singed all the hair off my forearm, and I hadn't realized it.
That's where adrenaline really takes over, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Everything slows down, and, you know, you had a plan on the way to the car, a plan to yank on the door if it didn't open, to try to break the window and reach in and pull him out, but fortunately the door did open.
That's probably some of that Army training, wasn't it?
Well, people told me later that God put me there at the right time because I had the training, I was big enough, and in the right position to do something.
Yeah, I'm
sure. I was the only one who did. There were cars backed up for miles behind me, but no one bothered to get out of their cars even.
Wow. Well, I'm sure that that person really appreciated the fact that you were there. Do you ever hear from him? Yeah.
He invited me to his condo a couple of months later and was very appreciative. He was a youth counselor for the Broward Youth Development Services. A very nice fellow.
Wow. How about that? Well, you went on, and then you have you taught, you said, at Cambridge and taught every science that there was from grade 7 through 12 for 12 years at Cambridge Academy.
Yes, not all in the same year, of course, but I don't think anyone could have managed that, but it was life science, earth science, physical science, biology, advanced biology, physics, chemistry, and they even threw in psychology there for 2 years.
Okay. Well, that's great. You've had a very interesting life then, haven't you?
I would say so, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. But how did you decide to get into being a Lincoln presenter? What brought that about?
Well, Lincoln was always my favorite president, and an aunt had given me the boyhood of Abraham Lincoln when I was probably 8 or 9, and I was very impressed by it, thought this was really a cool dude in the vernacular, and he became my boyhood hero along with Joe DiMaggio and Roy Rogers, which dates me quite obviously. And then about 5 years ago, I read an article in Newsweek. There were 5 or 6 gentlemen in Abraham Lincoln outfits, and it was a 3-page story, and the caption at the top of the article was, "Honest Abe, they're not Honest Abe." And it was about the Association of Lincoln Presenters, a national organization of about 175 individuals scattered all over the country. And I happen to be the only one in South Carolina. I'm not quite sure why that is, unless perhaps it's because we get the blame for starting the recent unpleasantness.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been all over the state. Never had a bad experience anywhere, never been heckled or teased or anything, and it's been a great retirement hobby. Everyone seems to enjoy the programs, and as I tell people who contact me, well, what do you want me to do? I can do anything from a 10-minute class walkthrough to a 6-hour program. Thus far, no one has asked for the 6 hours. But I remain hopeful.
You remain hopeful. Now, one of the things I was looking through, you've got quite a scrapbook here. One of the things, you jumped out of a plane.
Well, I figured for my birthday 2 years ago, we were doing a program for the Somerville Library, and it happened to be on my birthday, and the coordinator said, well, we'll change it to the next week because I know you won't want to do this on your birthday. I said, no, it'll be fine. You're putting us up in a motel. We'll do the program at your library, and you are having a buffet, you said, and they actually had a real nice cake for me, too. And the next morning, I went over to Walterboro and did a tandem skydive from 14,000 feet.
And you live to tell about it.
Oh, yes. My wife, Jiminelle, when I told her I was going to do this, she said, you can't do that. I'll have to have an ambulance standing by the runway. And I reassured her. I said, no, if you make a mistake skydiving, you don't need an ambulance. And once she'd been completely reassured, she was okay with it.
She went and found all your insurance papers, though, just
well,
to be
she
sure.
Did check.
Oh, I understand. I understand. Now, your wife has joined you in this venture as Mary Todd, but how did she get involved in it?
Well, when I told her I was going to become a Lincoln, she said, well, that's going to be your hobby, and don't expect me to have anything to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
The lady now owns 4 Mary Todd Lincoln gowns.
And how did she get involved?
Well, the first convention we went to was in Alton, Illinois, the last Lincoln-Douglas debate site, and there were about 25 Mayor Todd Lincolns there, all in their Civil War gowns, and they took her under their wing, so to speak, and converted her.
And converted her, and she came back as Mary Todd.
She's now Mayor Todd whenever she's able to. She manages the Bootery, so usually it's only weekends and evenings that she's able to make an appearance, but everyone, I think most of them would rather see her than me.
Why is that?
She's a lot better looking.
Well, you know, I love some of the stories. We're going to talk about some of the Lincoln stories here, but we also we need to talk about just a few of the uncanny things that are exactly the same, such as Abraham Lincoln was 6'4". Now, how tall are you?
I'm 6'4".
And Abraham Lincoln wore a size 14 narrow shoe, and what about you?
That is my size also.
How about had a stepmother named Sarah? And you have a
mother named Sarah, and she was born on Lincoln's birthday.
Oh, this is getting scary.
As was one of her older sisters.
This is getting scary. Now, Abraham Lincoln, of course, had four sons. How about you?
Four sons.
Let's see. What else shall we talk about? It says, of course, Abraham Lincoln was an excellent writer. You list yourself as a fair writer.
I can write somewhat.
Okay.
Lincoln, of course, was a poetic writer. The Gettysburg Address, the Second Inaugural, the Farewell to Springfield were just like poems.
Yeah.
He was an excellent writer.
How about your first? His first romantic interest was named Anne and died tragically young. That was Abraham Lincoln. And you?
The first girl with whom I was infatuated was also named Anne, and she also died tragically young. We both had sisters named Sarah. Both died young. And it went on and on. Lincoln had a severe concussion
at
the age
of
nine.
Yeah.
And I had a severe concussion at age 14. And
the only difference is a mule kicked.
Mule kicked him in the forehead. He was unconscious for 17 hours. And I was thrown through the windshield of a car from the back seat out onto the hood.
Mm-hmm.
And was unconscious for a short time. Had a very severe concussion.
And then, of course, there was number 12, shot at while riding to a soldier's home north of Washington. This is Abraham Lincoln. Bullet knocked his hat off his head and spooked the horse. And for you?
When I was stationed at Fort Meade, which is north of Washington, I was returning back late one Saturday night. No traffic anywhere in sight. And a bullet broke my windshield in front of my face and ricocheted off to the right. Had the shooter given 18 inches less lead, it would have hit me in the side of the head.
Wow. Okay.
And when I remembered that little incident, I quit trying to find similarities.
You can't.
That was enough.
Because where is that booth man? He's not here today, is he?
In fact, when I do a stage play at a school that has a curtain and I'm saying some of Lincoln's words, sometimes the hair will stand up on the back of my neck and I have an almost irresistible urge to turn and see if there's someone really behind me. But I'm afraid that it won't be Lincoln, it will be Booth.
Exactly. All right, we are here with Gerald Pitts. He is Abraham Lincoln. He knows Abraham Lincoln. We're going to be talking more about Abraham Lincoln. Hey, if you want to give us a call, give us a call. 229-7984. That's 229-7984. We're going to hear a quick word from our sponsors, and we'll be right back. Ready to race to you.
These days are gold, more precious than any other time in history. Do you have gold? Do you need cash? Then bring it to SFG. That's Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72, Greenwood. Telephone 229-6613. Don't forget, we buy diamonds too. Paying the highest prices for your gold and diamonds at Sharp Facets Gallery.
That's right. We are still here with Gerald Pitts. We are talking about Lincoln this afternoon. He is an Abraham Lincoln presenter. He represents, in fact, if you look at the video that we are doing right now that will be posted on YouTube, you'll be able to see him all dressed. In fact, he just checked the time with his pocket watch there. So there you go. But I was asking you before we came back on the air, I bet 2009, since that was a bicentennial, was a very busy year for Lincoln presenters, wasn't it?
The bicentennial was great. February, I think I did at least 12 different appearances. On the day of my birth, which was February 12th, I went to the school I attended for the 6th and 7th grade in Lawrence, and the local paper had a reporter, photojournalists followed me around the whole day, and the advertiser published a full page of color pictures and stories, which were just fantastic, so much so that I've had several copies laminated, and I've furnished them to organizations that want to use it in pre-publicity for an event.
Sure. But you were telling me you went to Washington, D.C.
our annual convention was held in Washington, of course. Where else?
Right.
And we had a big turnout. And picture, if you will, two chartered buses pulling up in front of the Lincoln Memorial, and about 78 Lincolns getting out and traipsing up the steps and lining up in ranks in front of the seated figure of Lincoln. Within 10 minutes, every tourist within five blocks was ranged in front of us, about 20 deep.
Trying to get a picture.
The film director and a park ranger finally had to stand on a chair and say, "People, if you'll all move back 30 feet, the Lincolns have said they'll stay an extra hour, and you can take all the pictures you want, and individual poses, whatever." And they moved back, and I was there for another hour, and at least 50 people from all over the world took my picture, and someone to come up and shake your hand with a very formal portrait. Others would drape an arm over my shoulder if they could reach that high, and someone to give you a big hug, but it was amazing.
It was amazing. Now, just for the record, I lost my train of thought. What was I going to say? I had a good question for you about this. So you were up there for that, and then any other events that were happening up there at that time?
Oh, quite a number. The Willard Hotel asked us to come and loiter around their lobby.
Loiter around the lobby?
You know, to attract the tourists, and they were nice enough to give us all a free luncheon, which would have cost $30 otherwise, and they gave each of us a nice special medallion that they had minted for the bicentennial. So it was well worth doing. We went to the African American Memorial, which supposedly lists the name of every African American that had died during the Civil War fighting in the United States colored troops.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, Lincoln and I was not convinced that the African Americans would be able to fight as well as the whites, but as it turned out, they were able soldiers once they were trained, and they wanted to fight for their freedom as much as any man, and they proved it in many battles, including the assault on Fort Wagner on Morris Island in South Carolina.
Oh, how about that? Now, just for the record, do you have to be any particular height, or are there any requirements to become a Lincoln presenter?
Well, we have a Lincoln up somewhere in New England who is 6'9".
6'9"?
So he's an overachiever. But we do have some shorter Lincolns. Charlie Brain, who was one of the founders, kind of shrank up as he aged, and Charlie died, unfortunately, last year. But he was about 5'11 when I met him, and he claimed he had started out at 6'4", but just gradually shrank down.
Gravity pulled him down, right? Okay. So that's what I was wondering. Do you have any, I guess what you're telling me is you
it's
don't?
It's mostly in the presentation and the way you put it across. I mean, you can convince someone that you're 6'4 if you think you're 6'4 and are talking like that.
Like 6'4". That's very interesting. Now, you're 6'4", but how tall is your top hat there? I mean, that's got to be a good 12, 16 inches something.
Well, it was made for me by a hatter in Santa Cruz to the specifications of the one in the Smithsonian.
Right.
And she did a magnificent
Lincoln
job with it. Leather band, his initials cool, monogrammed on the inside. And as you can see, I keep paperwork in there, as Lincoln did. The stovepipe hat was sort of the badge of office of the lawyers back in the mid-1800s. And
kind of like the wigs in the
when they were
England
riding the circuit, they would keep contracts and wills and other paperwork in their hats. It might be where the expression "keep it under your hat" originated.
There you go.
I'm not sure about that, but it sounds reasonable.
Exactly. That's pretty neat. But how tall is it from the
It's 9 inches from the brim to the crown.
Yeah, it looks taller than that there, so pretty interesting. Now, how big a head did Lincoln have?
7 1/8.
Okay.
And
how big is your head?
7 1/8.
Oh, come on now. This is just so scary here, folks. Do you ever feel that these likenesses are kind of spooky?
Actually, yes, I do. When I came up with 16 commonalities, as I've told you, I started to feel a little spooked by it, and I refused to sit in a balcony in any theater.
I wonder why. That would just be too much, wouldn't it? Well, we are here with Gerald Pitts. He is a South Carolina. He's a Lincoln presenter. When we come back, I think we're going to summon Lincoln himself right here to be part of our discussion here. So I certainly hope you're going to stay right with us right here on WCRS. I'll see if I can find Lincoln right around here somewhere. And when we come back, that's who we'll be talking to. In reality, it's Gerald Pitts, but he does a great job. So when we come back, I've got a couple of questions that have already come in. We'll be asking those questions. And, of course, the number to call, 229-7984. That's 229-7984.
This is Philip Biffle, your Greenwood Edward Jones Financial Advisor. Do you have a recovery plan for your investments? If not, there are several reasons we think you should. While interest rates are very low, certain income strategies and investments could help increase your investment income. Also, many investment portfolios are out of balance at a time when proper investment diversification may be most critical. You also may want to review your portfolio to consider replacing lower quality investments with higher quality investments that may be at attractive prices. No one can control what the market will do next. You can, however, take advantage of investment opportunities that exist today. At the same time, it is important to be well positioned for whatever the market does tomorrow. Please call me, Philip Biffle, or stop by my office today to develop your personalized recovery plan investment strategy. Please call me, Philip Biffle, at 229-0444, or stop by my office today to develop your personalized recovery plan investment strategy. Edward Jones, Making Sense of Investing, member SIPC.
Monday, happy days. Tuesday, Wednesday, happy days. Thursday, Friday, happy days. Saturday, what a day. Rock and roll.
We're right back here at Sharp Fastest Gallery having a fascinating time. I do have Gerald Pitts. Here he is, a Lincoln presenter. That means, yes, he's Abraham Lincoln. We did have a couple of calls come in. We've got a time for a couple of questions here. June Carlisle, her husband worked in procurement from 1942 to 1946, ordered 500,000 coffins for the invasion of Japan. We were talking about, 10,000 for Desert Storm, but they ordered 500,000 coffins for the invasion of Japan that they did not need, and thank goodness they didn't need it. But phenomenal. That's a little thing that you don't really think about, isn't it, Gerald?
Most people wouldn't. I did, because in July 1945, my father was in occupied Germany on redeployment orders to the South Pacific, and fortunately the atomic bombs were dropped and the Japanese capitulated.
Wow. Unbelievable. Now, one other question that either June or somebody else had, how much does it cost to have Abe to appear like the head of the Preservation Society?
I'm sponsored by the South Carolina Humanities Council. They pay a fee for me to come to any nonprofit organization, and generally I don't charge you anymore unless, for example, you're on the extreme edge of the state or I have to spend the night or something. I expect you to get me a motel at least.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, the Humanities Council pays the fee and there is no other fee.
And one of the other things, if you'd like more information about Gerald, the best thing you said was to just Google?
If you just Google Gerald with a G, middle initial Y, Pitts, you should get a half dozen websites, one of which will be the Humanities Council, several others, probably the Lincoln Association. All of these have my name, address, phone number, information, profiles, what I do. The Humanities Council site has both a speaker and a topic key, so either one of those will give you information.
Okay, so you can check that out, but you can also call him 223-1131. That's 223-1131. So, we're talking about Lincoln, you know, and I think it's about time that we just flip the switch and, you know, we just pull Lincoln out of the hat here. So, Mr. Abe Lincoln, how are you today?
I'm doing quite well, Mrs. Eller. Thank you very much.
Well, it certainly is a pleasure to have you here. Now, you know, here you are in the modern world looking back. I mean, what do you think?
Well, first, must express my amazement. I'm quite familiar with the telegraph as I use it at the War Office on a daily basis. And Mr. Samuel Morse was a brilliant man to invent that. But I must say, yes, and they can be translated into letters and thence into words.
Yes.
But to have this thing you call radio, where the electrical impulses apparently go in the air and can be plucked out of the air somehow, and the exact voice and words are right there reformed for you. I just cannot believe this.
And how about afterwards you'll be able to see yourself on a video on the Internet? Have you ever heard of such a thing, the Internet?
Does that have anything to do with fishing?
Nope. All the information you could ever want to know is right out there, right in space, kind of like this microphone thing we're talking about.
Well, the one term I spent as a representative in the U.S. Congress, I stayed in a boarding house across from the Library of Congress, and I spent every evening over in the library reading, learning what I could. I was always had a great thirst for knowledge and information, and as you know, I'm self-educated pretty much. I had less than a year's formal schooling. I went to.
And how could you become a lawyer?
Reading. I got the law books and I read them and studied till I could pass the Illinois bar exam. Took me just a little over 2 years, and I took the exam and passed it. And the
first
state,
time?
Yes, the first time.
Wow.
And I was a lawyer. They sent me a big certificate that said, "One Abraham Lincoln is hereby certified by the state of Illinois to practice before the bar." And I spent 25 years in Illinois as an attorney before being elected president.
Now, curiosity, you know, you have the name of Honest Abe. Now, what did that mean as far as your legal practice?
Well, as an attorney, later on...
Because we all know attorneys aren't really that honest in today's world. Now, maybe in the old school they were, but in today's world, our attorneys aren't always that honest. Sorry, attorneys, but it's true, and you know it.
Well, when I was practicing with Billy Herndon, later on, we'd get a law clerk in or somebody wanted to read law. I would sit him down first thing, and I would talk to him, and I'd say, "Now, first determine that you can be an honest lawyer. And if you decide in your own mind that you cannot be an honest lawyer, then be honest enough to go into another occupation where you can be honest."
And how about your clients?
Well, occasionally I would turn down a client if I was certain he was guilty or if I was afraid that he might give dishonest testimony to court. I walked out of a case one time when I realized that my client was sitting in the witness box and was lying before the court.
You walked out?
I got up and walked out. The judge, of course, sent the bailiff after me to fetch me back, but I told the bailiff, said, "Go back and tell his honor that my associate will continue the case. I've got my hands dirty, and I must go wash them," because I could not continue with a case where I knew my client was lying.
Wow. Okay. Now, your wife. How did you meet your wife?
Mary Todd. I'd been practicing law a few years in Springfield, and Ninian Edwards was one of the big dogs in town. His father had been governor of Illinois, and he was married to Elizabeth Todd from Lexington. And Elizabeth's sister, Mary, had come up from Lexington to live with her because her father had remarried. Her mother died when she was nine, as had my mother when I was nine. And Mary just couldn't get along with the stepmother at all. I was blessed to have probably the greatest stepmother a young boy could hope to have. But Mary just didn't get along with her, so she came to live with Nanny and then Elizabeth. And they had a cotillion or reception, and I was invited, and I was kind of hanging out in the corner by myself, and I noticed Mary, and she seemed to be a right comely miss. I believe she was 22 at the time, and the belle of the ball, so to speak, and I knew that Stephen Douglas, my political rival, had gone out with her, and finally I screwed up my courage and went over and said, "Miss Mary, I want to dance with you in the worst way possible," and to this day, she will tell you that I certainly did. She said that her toes were black and blue for weeks.
Now, I mean, I would just be curious, what were you actually wearing? Because, you know, I understand your wardrobe was not really that great, and you didn't spend a lot of time worrying about what to wear.
Mary, if she did anything for me, it was probably to civilize me.
Civilize you?
She dressed me up better than I would have been on my own. I was always a gangling fella and didn't pay too much attention to my clothes, usually a black flannel suit, and the pants might be too short, and sometimes I forgot to press them and be right wrinkled, but clothes were never of much importance in my mind. There's a different story with Mary. She spent a lot of time buying clothes, and at one time she owned 200 pairs of gloves when we were in the White House.
200 pairs of gloves?
Well, it's not as crazy as it sounds. You have to serve in a lot of reception lines, and you get your gloves dirty if you shake hands with several hundred people night after night. And so I reckon maybe she could have used, well, frankly, she could have used about a tenth that many, but...
It was okay.
Mary did what Mary wanted to do, generally speaking. I didn't try to hold her back much.
You know, in today's White House, nobody gets to go in the White House. I mean, you have to be invited to go to the White House. And, you know, there's a big fence around the White House, so nobody can even get close to the White House. But I understand your White House wasn't like that.
Oh, no, there were no fences at all. Completely open. There was a flock of sheep grazed on the south lawn. There were outhouses. We had a well on the north side and one on the south side. And one of the useful pieces of advice President Buchanan gave me as he left office was to say, Lincoln, the water in the well on the north side is better than that in the south side. But
did people actually camp out at the White House and stay at the White House?
Oh, in the afternoons, it was sort of open house. Folks would wander in, mostly in the beginning, to ask for jobs, government jobs. Everybody wanted a government job.
Even back then,
and,
huh?
And they would come in, ask to see the president, and sometimes the secretary, if they thought he was important enough or it warranted it, they might ask me if I wanted to come out and talk to him. And sometimes the groups would come in, I'd go out and speak to them. But generally speaking, there was no security or anything. People could just wander in the front door, wander around. More than once, Mary and I discovered the strangers upstairs in the living quarters just inspecting our belongings, you know. We didn't think too much of it. No one did. It was rather open.
Rather open. Not like it is today. Not like it is today. Well, here, we are here with Abraham Lincoln, a.k.a. Gerald Pitts. We'll be right back. Don't you go away.
Gold dust at my feet.
This year will be a simpler year. One fine gift to last a lifetime from Mother Earth with love. A diamond to light the way and create the energy to keep your love alive. Only at Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72 Greenwood, 229-6276.
Monday, happy days. Tuesday, Wednesday, happy days.
We're back here at Sharp Passes Gallery. Abraham Lincoln is in the building. I'm sitting across from Abraham Lincoln. Believe it or not, we're having quite a conversation. Now, Abraham, I understand that you actually drew quite a few stares at times because, well, tell us why. Why, when you were on the train, that some lady kept staring at you and finally you asked her about it?
Well, I was always a tall, gangly fellow, and not much to look at. Mary would even tell you that, I think.
What attracted Mary, then, just out of curiosity?
Well, Mary told other folks and myself later that when she saw me at her sister's home in Springfield, she thought to herself, that man is going to be president someday. And when I came over and asked her to dance, that was one of the reasons that she started dancing with me. And after a year or so, I proposed marriage to her, screwed up my courage, got cold feet, and jilted her. Went back down to Kentucky. Ran out on her. Left her waiting at the altar almost. And I went to visit my good friend Joshua Speed, with whom I'd boarded when I first landed in New Salem. And Joshua was married and had a baby, and he assured me that marriage was a wonderful institution in which to be in, closed. And finally, I screwed up courage, went back, went to see Mary again, and asked her, and she took me back. But she didn't take any chances. We were married the following evening in the parlor of Elizabeth and Ninian's home with two witnesses and a minister.
Well, all right. Now to get back to the story. You were on the train, and tell me about this.
I was traveling to a nearby city to get a deposition in a case I was handling, and I noticed the lady seated across from me seemed to be just staring holes through me. And I looked around, you know, looked behind me, and no, she was definitely staring really hard at me. And finally, I couldn't take it any longer. I leaned over and said, "Ma'am, is there something wrong? You seem to be staring at me." And she kind of leaned back, and she looked at me, and she said, "I do believe you're the ugliest man that I have ever seen." And I was somewhat taken aback, and I said, "Well, ma'am, what you see is what the good Creator is, how He made me, and I don't reckon there's anything I can do about it." Whereupon she looked me right in the eyes and said, "You could at least stay home."
Well, what made you decide, after comments like that, what made you decide to pursue political office?
Well, as a young fella in New Salem in my mid-20s, I kind of got the political bug, and folks urged me to run for the Illinois legislature, and finally I decided I would, so I registered. But about that time, the Black Hawk War came along, and they called up a militia, six fellows, and they elected me captain of the militia. And I must say, even today, that's probably one of the things of which I'm most proud, that I was elected captain of the militia during the Black Hawk War. And we went out for 3 months and came back much bloodied from the mosquitoes. We never saw a single Indian. And by then, it was too late to do any campaigning, so I came in last in that election. But I won the next four, and I served in the Illinois House of Representatives for 4 terms.
I would just be curious, being so tall, was, you know, because men used not to be so tall, did they? I mean, 6'4 was exceptionally tall.
Generally, I was the tallest fellow around. Occasionally, I'd meet a fellow who looked to be my height or maybe taller, and I'd stand back to back with him and take the measures to see which of us was actually the taller.
Mm-hmm.
And I did meet 2 or 3 fellers who were just a little bit taller than me, but in some of the 10 types that you see, my generals around me looked much smaller, especially George McClellan, who was known as Little Napoleon. Now, George is a whole story by himself, so I won't get into him. But
well, I was going to say, wouldn't that be dangerous to be in war with somebody that was as tall? I mean, that would be a little bit more scary, wouldn't it?
Well, I always seemed to have a premonition that whatever was going to happen would happen. I sort of believed in that there was a direction that God had charted for us, and I never paid much attention to security. My self-appointed friend and bodyguard, Ward Hill Lamon, when I got on the inaugural train to go to Washington, which was an 11-day trip, he was outfitted with 3 pistols and 2 knives, and he and another friend and Secretary Designate Seward, warned me that they caught wind of a plot in Baltimore to assassinate me. And I put no stock in it at the time, but eventually as we got closer, more information came out, and I did as Mr. Lamon advised, you know, sort of camouflage myself, and we changed trains. And I got through safely, and as it turned out, there actually was a plot, apparently, to try to kidnap me or to kill me.
Now, but it was Mary that actually thought you should become president. Is she the one that pushed you to become more political?
She encouraged me. She helped me out. Of course, her sister and Ninian, with their political connections, were a help. But once I got into it, I seemed to have a knack for politics. People say could make a good speech now and then. And
yeah, you did make a few good ones, didn't you?
Well, so people tell me. At the time, I had my doubts about them. For example, one by which most people said a lot of store was the Gettysburg Address, so-called. And after I gave that, I thought it was a complete failure. The speaker before me and the guest of honor had been Everett Edwards, who was the foremost orator in the entire country, president of Harvard. He spoke for 2 hours. And I spoke for a little less than 2 minutes. In fact, the 10-type photographer didn't even get a picture of me because I was up and down by the time he had his camera set up. But some of the newspapers panned it severely, and a few thought, well, that was a good speech. And later on, people began to think maybe that was a good speech, and I've come around to that view myself.
you know, in today's world, in, you know, we're in the modern world here, and of course, I think it's amazing that you can be here today, particularly after what happened to you. You know, did you have much security when you were shot?
Oh, no, there was no security. When my hat was shot off my head in 64, while I was on the way to the soldier's home, I was going alone, as I usually did, and people kept pestering me that I should have security. Now, the night at Ford's Theater, General Grant and Julia were supposed to be there, and had they attended, he would have had a whole squad of soldiers guarding him, at least six or more. But as the president, I had no assigned security. There was an off-duty policeman who sat outside the door on a chair, but as soon as the play started, he left and went down and got my coachman, and they went to the bar next door and began drinking. So there was no one outside the door when Booth came up to do his dirty work.
Looking back over your time that you did spend in office, what do you think about all that went on? What do you think?
Well, it was my sole intention was to preserve the Union. I considered that the United States had to be all one country, that we could not be dividing up and dividing again, as I was certain would happen. After all, our national motto was E Pluribus Unum, out of many, one. And we had to stay that way. That was the sole reason that I followed through when Fort Sumter was fired upon and called for volunteers to preserve the Union by force of arms if necessary. The previous March, I'd sworn a sacred oath on the Bible to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. So I had no choice but to try to preserve the Union by whatever means necessary. The following year, I began to think that emancipating the slaves in the South would have a benefit. One, we were getting thousands of contrabands across the into our lines every day, and the generals didn't know what to do with them. And Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist and writer, had been urging me to form a United States colored troops and allow them to help fight for their own freedom. And by the summer of 62, I decided that I had to write an Emancipation Proclamation, and over a period of many weeks, I wrote it, and I discussed it with some of the cabinet members and generals, and they suggested that it would be better if we waited till we had some sort of a victory, because up to that point, there had been no victories.
This is WCRS right here in Greenwood. We're going to run over here a little bit. So as you were looking at all this, it's had to be a terrible time for you.
I agonized. Mary and I lost our darling little Willie to typhoid in February of 62. It was devastating to Mary and to myself also, but I thought how many other fathers and mothers and brothers are bereft of their loved ones in this terrible war, at the conclusion of which Secretary Stanton informed me that, comparing estimates from his southern counterpart, Breckinridge, that over 600,000 casualties. Unbelievable number. So much bloodshed. Too much bloodshed.
So what'd you do?
As best I could. I kept appointing the generals I thought would succeed. And after going through seven, I finally hit upon Ulysses S. Grant. Twice, politicians and other generals had tried to get me to relieve him, once saying he was incompetent and that he was a drinker. And I said, just let me know what brand of whiskey he takes, and I will furnish a case to each of my generals. Another time, I simply said, I cannot spare this man. He fights.
Absolutely. You know, President Barack Obama is our president, the first black president of the United States of America here now, and he compares himself quite a bit to you.
So I've heard. I know Abraham Lincoln, And Barack Obama is no Abraham Lincoln.
He's not. He's not. Ah, I see. So you know, here we are on the verge of another election right here. It's 2012. We have a big election coming up here. Would you have any words of wisdom for our candidates and for our school children here today who just seem to be so lacking in history and civics and this type of thing as we round this up here, Abraham Lincoln?
Well, how much time do we have?
We don't have a lot.
Well, very quickly, I'd tell the school children, study, read, learn all that you can. I had less than a year's worth of schooling, and I became president. I read. Be honest in all of your endeavors. It will delight your friends and confuse your enemies. Be diligent. Persevere. Never give up. I failed 11 times in politics. I went bankrupt twice trying to run a general store, but I persevered. And finally, if I could close with what I think would be appropriate, given the times today.
Is this a word to our candidates, maybe, or is this to the whole United States?
This is to the whole United States and to the candidates. The last part of my first inaugural address. As God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and a lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations. That applies, of course, to our overseas conflicts. And finally, politically speaking, we need to do the following. Highly resolve that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
Absolutely. Well, Abraham Lincoln, a.k.a. Gerald Pitts, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you here today. If you'd like to find more about our Lincoln presenter here, Gerald Pitts, all you have to do is Google him. It's Gerald with a G, and Y is his middle initial, Pitts. And, of course, if you'd like to call him, you can call him at 223-1131. That's 223-1131. Abraham Lincoln, Gerald Pitts, it's been a pleasure having you here today.
Well, it's all my pleasure, Mrs. Eller. And if you're in Washington, do drop by the White House and pay me a visit.
I would love to do that, absolutely. This is WCRS right here in Greenwood. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Tomorrow morning, we got quite a schedule. Who do we have? Tomorrow morning at 8:35, we have Congressman Tim Scott. 9:05, we have Curtis Loftus. And we may even have another guest after that, so make sure you tune in on the Isle of Ann show. Hey, I'm Ann Eller. It's been a blast here today, as it always is. So you keep it right here on WCRS. That's 1450 AM right here in Greenwood, South Carolina. Bye-bye, everybody. Happy days.